Will you please give a Montana welcome to Joe and Franco Esquire?
Hey, thank you all, and thank you for coming tonight. Let me just try to give you a little layout of how we'll do this. And the first part of tonight, I'd like to talk about the non-discrimination ordinance and address generally what that means and what we mean when we talk about threats to religious liberty. And the second part, I'd like to talk about the subject of marriage, since your marriage amendment is also under attack. And in that, I'd like to just go into some of the questions you typically hear. Like, what is the problem? You know, why should people be opposed to marriage redefinition? How do you answer questions like, well, is that like some kind of bigotry? Is that like people who opposed interracial marriage and the, you know, before those miscegenation laws, they were called, were struck down? Don't people need benefits? Is it somehow unkind? Or are we sort of discriminatory types of people? And those sorts of questions that are often troubling for people of faith. And so I'd like to go into some of that and why the government even bothers or cares about marriage. So that'll be the second half. But the first half will maybe focus on this, the non-discrimination ordinance. And let me say, I get the feeling that probably this is a friendly audience. There may be people here who have a different view. And you're welcome, and I hope that you'll listen with an open mind and an open heart. And I do think the winners, when we can talk about these things, the winners are everyone, if we can sit down and we can have some rational discourse. I don't think it helps us as citizens, as Americans. It doesn't help us when there's an effort to close down discussion through name-calling, through using language in a way that really is tyrannical. So I just want to just lay some groundwork with that. I've been practicing 36 years and doing religious liberty litigation and representing churches a lot of that time. It is remarkable to see how far things have come. I'll just say I'm seeing things now that I heard people warning about decades ago that I didn't think really I would see in my lifetime or my lifetime as a professional. And because we have such a, the network is now actually over 2,300 allied attorneys, and we have a staff of 40 attorneys. But over the years, you get to watch how these things happen. You see them develop in various states. You see how the arguments are made and what these things look like in practice. And as those things develop, you get a chance just to see, you know, you get to see the lay of the land and ultimately where things are going. And let me just say, generally, when people are interested in these issues, there is an agenda. And an agenda doesn't have to be a bad thing, but agenda means there's a goal, there's an aim of some sort. And that's just natural. You know, we're celebrating the 70th anniversary of the invasion at D-Day, and what an event it was when the Allied troops, you know, hit the beaches in places like Omaha Beach. They said that so many men died that the waters there in the beach ran red with the blood. And I think if anybody looked at that event back then and said to people, oh, well, we're only interested in taking a beachhead because we like the climate here in France, we don't plan on doing anything else with it, it would have been ludicrous. Nobody would have thought that that was a serious comment. Because you take that as a next step for where you're planning, because people ultimately have competing views on what society should look like, what culture should look like. And let me say as well that when we talk about these things, things get tossed around very lightly and very quickly. Like people say things like, I have a right to such and such. And I think one of the things I want to open with, and for some of you who are at the breakfast this morning, I apologize that some of this will be repetitive. No rights in this country exist in a vacuum. We have, for example, First Amendment rights for freedom of speech. But the Supreme Court famously observed in a case, that doesn't mean you have the right to shout out fire in a crowded theater. Rights are always balanced and interests are always balanced. But one of the points I would like to make to you is this, and this is kind of a preliminary framing of the issue. That is, rights really come from one of two places. If you're talking about rights, if somebody's walking down the street and they say, I've got a right to this. If you were to ask the question, why do you have a right? There's one of two places that rights can possibly come from. One is they can come from God, and the second is they can come from government, man, which I'll refer to as the state. And when I say the state, when you hear the expression separation of church and state, it's not, of course, referring to a particular state like Montana. It's the idea generally of government. But rights have to come from one or the other. And people feel very strongly, you know, in those two camps. And one of the dangers about that second camp is if rights come from the government, you have those rights as long as the government wants to give them to you. And what the government can give to you, it can take away. And the founding genius of this country, part of that was the idea that rights came from the Creator and that there was a higher moral authority than what government might tell you. And that government those rights from the Creator dictated how you worshiped, what your conscience demanded of you, what you were going to do. And so that's why you'll read, for example, in the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson was not a particularly devout man. He was more of a deist than a Christian. But he writes unashamedly, we hold these truths to be self-evident. And that, you know, these are beautiful words, but that don't lose the impact of them. Self-evident means this is so obvious to us, we don't even have to take time to explain it. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. It's a hard word to say. Now, what people don't always understand if they don't know history was that the American Revolution was a direct repudiation of the French Revolution. The French Revolution idealized the state. It idealized, in fact, it ridiculed the place of religion. The French had a habit during the time of the French Revolution, they'd go into a town, they'd find a young woman, and they'd dress her up and put her on a cart, and they'd say, this is the goddess of reason. Let's worship the goddess of reason. And you look to see how did that work out for them. Instead of the idea of a moral source of rights, how did it work out that they were worshiping reason and trusting people? Well, the French Revolution was a bloody, dismal failure. But the idea here was this, that because rights come from God, a tyrannical government cannot take them away. They do not own your soul. They do not own your heart. And their view is something like this. When a government takes away those fundamental rights of your conscience and how you're going to believe and how you're going to worship, they said, it's not only your right, it's your duty to overthrow an oppressive government that would do that to you. And that's why immediately after the Constitution, when they ratified the Bill of Rights, the very First Amendment and the very first part of the First Amendment opened with the words, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Why did it open with those words? This is a powerful concept. They were making a statement. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. What that meant was, we do not want a Church of England here. We do not want government compelling us. This is the official government church. We're taking your money to support it. If you don't like what it believes, too bad for you. That was that they put that as far away as they could. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Congress was not allowed to make laws that prevented you from the exercise of your religion. Now, as with anything, there's always no right is absolute. You know, if somebody's religion includes human sacrifice, courts have tests that they use, there's times the government interest will outweigh your, you know, what you claim to be your religious exercise. But they were talking generally about the Judeo-Christian worldview that they have. And so their view was that these rights were fundamental, and that because rights came from God, every other right was built on that cornerstone. So the First Amendment rights of speech, the right to associate together as people, the freedom of the press. They all depended on having people who were free of this sort of government tyranny. And I would really argue that religious freedom was so important, it was so understood by them, that they actually took it for granted. And you know, even back at that, they even technically had state-established churches. So now why do I say this? I say this because I'm giving you this background because what we're facing today when you look at a non-discrimination ordinance is there's inevitable conflicts between these goals of discrimination and religious freedom. I remember being at conferences, one conference where everybody was really going to try to share views and understand this. We had every possible view represented. In the end, we just could not agree on things, except for one thing. What everybody agreed on is these are inconsistent. It's a train wreck waiting to happen. And so a lot of times when I get in public places or if I'm doing debates with the other side on these issues, I talk about why it is religious freedom is important and how it's actually a guarantee. It's a help against the instinct that you find in governments towards wanting to control every part of your life. And I want to give you one example and that I think really is a good lesson for today. You know, the 20th century is littered with a lot of totalitarian states. It's no coincidence that the largest of them were atheist states. When the communist revolution came to Russia, if you look at the communist revolution or takeover in China, Maoist China, subsequently Stalinist Russia, and all these places, it's no coincidence that they were atheistic states because they did not want somebody saying there's a higher source of authority than the government. So that was why somebody like Mussolini in Italy would say, everything in the state, everything for the state, nothing outside the state. Because the state was supposed to take care of you, be the authority, speak control over every area of your life. And if somebody had these, you know, kind of pesky religious views, it might be that they don't want to go along with the government. And an example that I think is really, you know, needs to be understood by us is what happened in Germany in the 1930s. In Germany in the 1930s, you had the National Socialist Party, better known as the Nazis. And as they came into power, you know, churches were actually pretty well established in the German culture, especially Lutheran churches and Catholic churches. And Germany didn't have the option, or the Nazis didn't have the option of just closing down churches right away. But they started tightening the screw gradually, and as they got into areas that they wanted to govern, they said to churches, if you disagree with us, you can't speak on those issues. And in the end, they required that no church could be a church unless the pastor signed an agreement that we will never teach anything that contradicts the tenets, the beliefs, the teachings of National Socialism. And if you didn't sign that, you were closed down as a church. And if you kept criticizing the church, you got thrown into prison. So there were men, and maybe some of you have heard the names, Martin Niemöller, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who were pastors who opposed this because they said, you can't tell us what a church should believe. The church has a higher authority than what government decides to dictate. We answer to God. We answer not to man. And those among you, you know, who are Christians, I'm a Christian and I'm openly a Christian. The arguments we make in courts are not about my faith or beliefs. We have to make policy arguments. But you see the tradition of this, for example, when Peter and John are dragged before the Sanhedrin and they're commanded, don't preach in this name again. And their response is not, well, maybe we should develop a friendship with them and get to know them, and we might have a chance. No, their response is, whether it's right to obey God or man, you decide. On our part, we are going to obey God. And if there were consequences to that, they were willing to take the consequences. Now, these views are inconsistent, because what happens with these non-discrimination ordinances is if you have a religious objection to taking part in something that they think contradicts the goal of that, you must give up your religious beliefs. The Supreme Court of New Mexico, in a case we had, said the price of citizenship is getting along and you're giving up your religious beliefs. Even though these beliefs were understood to be the foundation of all of the rights. Ironically, they protect the rights that these people are trying to assert here. So, for example, in 2003, when same-sex marriage came to the first state in this country, in Massachusetts, almost immediately after that happened, the state went to Catholic Charities, and they had an adoption agency. And they said, you must now place children with same-sex couples. Catholic Charities said, that violates our faith. There's plenty of adoption agencies. People can use the other ones. They said, that's not good enough. You must either make those placements or we're going to close you down. There was not going to be a religious exemption for that. And Catholic Charities said, we won't do it. And by the way, they specialize in more difficult adoptions, kids who were older, kids who had physical challenges and all that. The state didn't care. Catholic Charities closed their doors. Now, who was harmed by that? Who's the real victim there? Yeah, the kids. But see, sometimes people don't care when they're ideologically driven. We can't have any disagreement on this. And what we have found is that that's what happens. It happens in businesses. It happens in universities. It happens in religious nonprofits. And it happens in churches. And we're seeing more of them. There are dozens of these cases going on, more than that. Many more coming. We hear reports of them every day. But let me give you some examples of it so you understand. Even churches eventually come into this. It's not unusual that initially non-discrimination ordinances have some kind of a limited religious, you know, exemption maybe for churches. A number of them don't even have that. And some of the ones that start with religious exemptions, they're gone pretty quickly. State of New Jersey makes sexual orientation and so-called gender identity protected under New Jersey state law. Two women went to our client Ocean Grove Methodist Church, and they said, you have a little camp pavilion on the water. We'd like to use that pavilion for a same-sex ceremony. We know you let people go in there sometimes. The pastor replied, you are welcome to come in and worship with us. You're welcome to, you know, we'd like to get to know you. But we can't allow that ceremony to take place in our property because it violates our theology. The women filed a complaint with the State Human Rights Commission. And these state human rights commissions they're looking for, and you kind of find what you're looking for, you know what I mean? And they found that the church violated the state anti-discrimination laws and took away the property tax exemption on that piece of property. Now, we were able to litigate and get it back, but we now see churches are now facing these types of issues. I've seen arguments coming up in states where people say, well, churches are like places of public accommodation. What's a place of public accommodation? Public accommodation, and that's where these anti-discrimination laws generally apply, places like restaurants, amusement parks, you know, hotels and things like that. Let me say, nobody cares about that. I've never met a person who has said, I don't want to serve people in my restaurant or my hotel. It just doesn't happen. The complaints you'll hear about or when people are forced to actually get into affirming the ceremony itself. But now I'm seeing the first hints of, well, your church lets visitors come. Anybody can walk in on a Sunday, right? Yeah. Well, you're like a place of public accommodation. Maybe we should apply this to you. Or other churches who are now getting requests from same-sex couples, hey, we think you let people outside of your church occasionally use your building, can we use this also for our, you know, commitment ceremony or same-sex marriage? And I've never seen so many pastors frightened, like, what has this brought that we did not see coming? We see it in religious nonprofits. It's amazing how many schools are experiencing these. Catholic schools seem to be a kind of a special target of this. There's quite a few Catholic schools now that have been sued because an employee comes in one day and says, I'm moving in with my partner. And by the way, sometimes they just have a rule that you can't, you know, live in a relationship if you're not married. And they don't even distinguish heterosexual, homosexual. You can't be in an unmarried relationship if that violates their teaching. And if they fire somebody into those circumstances, they're now getting dragged into human rights commissions or getting sued in court. There have been a number of cases of teachers. And usually the way it's worked is it's a male teacher who is there 25, 30 years and one day decides that he's actually a woman, and they show up wearing women's clothes, and the churches have said, we're not going to allow that here. You can't convey our theology and our beliefs because you're violating them. And they end up suing the schools. So these are the kinds of things that happen. We're seeing it in universities. We have filed, we've won over 100, you know, we've won close to 100% of the cases we filed too. But we filed many cases. We've been involved in more than 100 that have had decisions and plenty more to go, because the public universities have become so hostile in some instances that they will say to people, you can no longer even get a degree in psychology, in counseling, in social work, if you don't toe the new line, if you don't espouse the new government orthodoxy. I could tell you plenty of stories. I'll tell you one. Julia Ward, who's in Eastern Michigan University in the counseling program, she's a graduate student, very devout Christian. She has a 3.91 grade point average. She comes to the end of her time there, and she's got to do what they call the practicum, the final assignment before she gets her graduate degree. The assignment, she asks, I don't want an assignment where I have somebody who's unmarried in a relationship where you want me to affirm the relationship. And it made no difference if it was a man, a woman, or same sex. She just didn't believe in that. And sure enough, her assignment came, and what short straw did she happen to get? This person's in a same-sex relationship. Counsel them and affirm the relationship. So she turns around, and she says, I'm going to ask for a values conflict referral. What are values conflict referrals? They're very common in the counseling profession, it turns out. They're very liberally granted. It might be, you know, the counselor might be a Holocaust survivor, and the person coming for counseling is a neo-Nazi who wants help with his organizational skills. So the counselor looks and says, this is not going to be a good match, all right? We're not going to be good for each other. So you make a referral. And they're very, very common on sex issues. And so Julia said, okay, I'm going to ask for a values conflict referral. They had never failed to give a values conflict to anybody who just felt uncomfortable for any reason. And you can imagine the situations, you know, the many that could occur. You know, there were situations you have maybe a counselor who's a rape victim, and the person coming, you know, is a rapist or something like that. They want to give these. They're needed. It's the first one they ever turned down. They said to her, that's not good enough. You're violating the anti-discrimination ordinance in the university. We'll give you one of two choices. We'll either put you through re-education to train you to help you get rid of your bigotry, or we'll throw you out of the school. She said, I am not going for any kind of re-education, or whatever you want to call it, based on my beliefs. And they threw her out of school, and we filed suit, and thankfully we won that case in the Federal Court of Appeals there in the Sixth Circuit. Yeah. And the court said, no, you know, she has free exercise of religion rights. But the point is, it was the wrong answer. And the other thing that's evident in this as well is that when somebody has the wrong answer, the latest trend is we want to put that person for retraining. We want to re-educate them because they're not thinking the right way. We had a case, for example, just this week. A lot of these cases have come up with bakers, florists, photographers. We had a baker case just this week. No surprise, we lost in the Human Rights Commission. This baker did not want to bake a cake and design it for a same-sex wedding ceremony. It violated his Christian faith, he said. He would have sold these men happily anything off the shelf, but he did not want to be a part of celebrating that ceremony. So the Human Rights Commission came down against him, and part of the finding against him is not just a fine, but they also said, You have to go for re-education. You've got to get training. You've got to provide your employees with this regular instruction on how terrible discrimination is and all these other things that they piled onto it. Because it's the wrong answer, and the thinking there is we're not going to allow this kind of thinking to happen. I mean, here's another one that's outrageous. We represent a couple in Hawaii, Aloha Bed and Breakfast. It's an older couple. They're on a fixed income. So they took some rooms in their own home and they rent them out because they have a nice view overlooking, you know, the beach there. And they call it Aloha Bed and Breakfast. And people come and they share the home with them. They have meals. They get to know people. But they've had a rule from day one that they will not allow an unmarried couple to come together into the house. And so when two women filed and said, we want to come in or we want to, you know, visit Aloha Bed and Breakfast and stay there, they declined it. And, of course, they filed their complaint with the State Human Rights Commission. The State Human Rights Commission predictably not only found against them, part of their reeducation is they're told they have to put a sign up in their own home that says we do not discriminate on the basis of all of these things. Hang it in your kitchen where you'll see it every morning. But this is the kind of thinking that we regularly encounter. Or we have Baronelle Stutzman, Arlene's Flowers in the state of Washington. She had these two men who were customers. She loved these guys. She's this wonderful grandmotherly type. Watch her video on our website to see the face of a bigot. And she would greet these guys. She hugs everybody. When one of them came in at one point and said, hey, the law just changed. We're going to get married. We'd like you to come into the church, you know, the place to do our flowers, do our arrangements. She was really troubled by it. She took time to pray about this, she said. And she got back to them and she said, you know, I love the two of you. You're like kids to me. You know, I view you like my own kids. I can't do this. It violates my sincerely held religious beliefs on the meaning of marriage. They understood at first and they walked away. Word got out, you know, people started blogging on it and all that. The state attorney general steps into it and does something he's never done, starts a state investigation against her to prosecute her for this, what he calls this bigotry. And then eventually, you know, the two men, you know, sort of jumped into this as well. So we're seeing these things happen in so many of these instances. And, you know, we see the same evidence of this in the culture. It's interesting to see. Actually, I'm going to hold off on that thought for a minute because I want to touch on something else, and I'll come back to what I was going to say about the culture. Let me just back up for a minute because I want to make this point as well. If you think about this, there's a fundamental foolishness to this idea that we want to force people to do things that they don't want to do. Let me ask you all a question. If you were going to hire a photographer and the photographer said, I don't want to do any work for you. I've looked at you up and, you know, I don't like what you stand for. Would you want to force that person to do the work for you? Aside from the fact they wouldn't want them to have my money, I'd be worried what the product's going to look like, you know? Gee, I'm sorry the pictures didn't come out real well. The light was off or something, and my thumb kept getting in front of, you know, the thing there. Yeah. So but we understand that. You wouldn't want somebody to do those things in that case. And yet, even though in every one of these cases we've had, the florists who turned it down, this couple had dozens of offers for florists. There were tons of bakers. There's all of these other options. It's not good enough that somebody has a religious conscience, trouble with this. We're going to compel them and put them out of business because those religious values, have to be squelched because we don't want anything interfering with this anti-discrimination. Now, if there's plenty of other options, what's the problem with somebody taking another option? There's no point to this except we intend to punish the person who has that and make an example of them because we want to control these things, and we even want to control the way that people think. And here's the other interesting part to this. And in these cases, and we argue this, and it's come up in debates, we'll ask them, for example, would you compel the African-American photographer to film a KKK rally? Well, they say, no, we would never do that. It would hurt his feelings. But the KKK maybe is not protected by law. Okay, let's take somebody protected by the anti-discrimination laws. Religion. Let's take the Westboro Baptists who go to the funerals with the horrible signs and all that. Would you compel, if that photographer was a lesbian, would you compel her to film their event if they wanted to hire her? Well, no, she shouldn't have to do that. The only people who have to do it, in their view, are people who have traditional Christian views, because in their eyes, it is the wrong answer. This is an ideological battle, and this is the way it plays out. And I've watched it in other states, and it gets progressively worse, progressively worse, progressively worse. It may start smaller. It may start, there are states now that don't have religious exemptions where there will be lawsuits because people have religious rights. But there's also going to be lawsuits because it's what we call compelled speech. See, you have freedom of speech, but part of what the Supreme Court has said about freedom of speech, you not only have the right to speak, you have the right to not be forced to give a message that you don't want to give. And there's plenty of Supreme Court decisions on that. So when you get a photographer, when you ask that photographer in New Mexico, why don't you want to do this? Aside from her religious conviction, she would say, I'm using my God-given talents. I'm creating speech. I'm creating an event. They don't call themselves photographers anymore. I found my daughter got married. They're all photojournalists now because it's a way they can charge a lot more money, My wife is saying, yeah, but look how good they are. And I'm just thinking, yeah, I know how much that costs, right? I get this. I don't want anybody who calls themselves a hairstylist. I like a barber, somebody who's cheap. I don't have that much to cut. I don't see the point of it. But putting that aside, photographers are now photojournalists because they'll tell you they're creating an event. They're using their talent to tell your story, to pose the couple and all these other things. So we're compelling people to use those talents in ways that violate their faith. We've seen it in other areas. We've represented, for example, nurses in both New York City and New Jersey. And this is a different subject, but you'll get the point, where they had religious objections against abortion. They worked in hospitals and places where they were told, okay, you won't have to take part in an abortion. Putting aside the issue of how anybody feels about abortion, I hope we can all agree that if somebody has a religious objection, we don't compel them to take part in it, right? Well, there were instances where they were threatened, you'll be fired if you don't take part in this. We don't care about your religious objections because this is a matter of women's rights and we're insisting that you do this. Or another example of it is the Hobby Lobby Conestoga Wood case. Maybe some of you have followed that before the Supreme Court. Conestoga Wood is our client. We're involved in that case. We've been involved, by the way, in some capacity or other in 41 cases before the Supreme Court where there have been wins, thanks to the grace of God. But what's happening in that case now is there are business owners. Our clients are a Mennonite family in Pennsylvania. They're cabinet makers, wonderful people. They provide their employees with very generous health insurance. But they do not want to be compelled to provide coverage that includes what are arguably abortifacients. But they're being told now, in the regulations put out under the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, that you have to provide these and pay for them. You don't have a free exercise right to disagree because we, the government, know what's best and you have to go along with what we determine. So there's this, in many contexts outside of the immediate subject here, you see this undermining of religious freedom and this very critical fundamental right that dictates our conscience, that dictates how we raise our children and what we do with our families. Some of the examples that are coming from this, and let me just take one part of what comes with the sexual orientation, gender identity type ordinances, and they always include gender identity. The latest thinkers on the other side now say, It used to be, you know, GLBTQQ, and the letters kept adding. The latest theorists on their side, as I read this stuff, say that there's an infinite number of genders. Don't ask me how that is, but that's what they think. If any of you go on Facebook, I don't ever go on, but check it. I'm told now that you have a choice of more than 50 genders. It's sort of a deconstruction of traditional understandings. And one of the things that comes with this is people now are told it's like a civil right issue that you be able to use the locker room or the bathroom that you identify with instead of your biological sex. And if that bothers other people, then that's too bad. And these laws very often have subjective elements. They're not even objective. They're subjective, meaning if the person thinks that you're trying to make them feel bad, that can be enough to trigger it where you have violated the law. So if I was in a restaurant and my daughter was in the restroom and some guy was walking in and I said, pardon me, don't go in there, that's the ladies' room. If he thought I was saying that to give him a hard time or make him feel bad about himself, that would be a basis in many of the ordinances I've seen to file charges against me. And as I've been telling crowds all day, if he tried to get in there while my daughter was in there, they'd file multiple charges against me. All right. So, but so what's happening though is as this happens, it gets into colleges. I'm waiting for this to happen, and this is going to be very interesting because at some point, the arguments they make start turning on themselves. Like right now, there's a very big battle between the feminists, the old sort of 60s style feminists, and the gender people, because the feminists say we have to break down sex stereotypes, and the gender arguers say we have to build them up to explain what we are. There was an incident last week at some event, I don't know what it was, where these guys who identify as women, they say, went to the feminist table and destroyed the materials and attacked them with magic markers. I'm not quite sure why they did that, but they attacked them with magic markers, according to the story. But these things eventually start breaking down on them, on themselves because of all the inconsistencies that happen. But for example, I could tell you stories, what's happened in Florida, what's happened. I'm waiting for this to happen. I'm waiting for, under federal law, what's called Title IX, women sports get equal funding. I'm waiting for the public university where a group of men go and say, we're joining the women's volleyball team because we think that we're women, and you're not allowed to question them, when women are going to say, we just lost a bunch of scholarships to these guys because they said that they think they're women. Should that be happening from this? These kinds of things are going to happen. But in Massachusetts, for example, if you go to the Department of Education guidelines on how to deal with this, because now students have to be allowed under these new anti-discrimination ideals to use the locker room that they want, you will see in the state guidelines, well, what happens if people are uncomfortable with the other sex using the locker room? Well, your duty is to help those people understand. So in other words, under their guidelines, if the girls are upset because a guy is coming into the locker room with them, the school's response, the enlightened response, is supposed to be, help them overcome those bigotries over the male body in the locker room with them. And I just want to say this, in so many states and places, it's like the one thing follows the next. Like, there's a lawsuit now in your state for something like domestic partnership benefits. And I'll talk more about this in the second session. And in that lawsuit, what we've seen lawsuits filed in states before same-sex marriage caught on as much as it did, where they said, we have to sue because we have no way to get these benefits. We are discriminated against for benefits. Well, I knew exactly what was going to happen. They had, their lawyers had discussed it in advance. The moment the ink was dry on a domestic partnership or civil union law, they turned around and sued for marriage because they said, well, it's irrational for you not to give us marriage. You just gave us all the benefits. The only thing you're not giving us, their word, the dignity of the title. So, immediately, those kinds of lawsuits follow. And let me say, now, how do we respond to these? I think a couple things we need to be aware of. You know, we are people, I believe, of good faith. We like to get along. We love people. If you happen to be a Christian, you know, as I am, we look and we are aware of our own sin nature and failings. And so we say, well, we are open to understand, you know, that okay, there's nobody who is without sin. That's sort of basic Christian orthodoxy, wherever you fall in it, if you happen to be Christian. But one of the things that, you know, that happens is that goodness stumbles us. And the other thing that is a problem for us is the use of words, because the other side uses words and vocabulary and even straw man arguments that paralyze us. For example, you know, if you have a really cruddy law, and there's a few legislators here, just call it the Healthy Children Act. What does that mean? Well, if I don't like the law and I'm a legislator, oh, you must be against healthy children. Well, that's preposterous. Maybe I just don't like the law or the approach of the law. But these words become tyrannical. So, for example, one of those words is tolerance. Tolerance used to mean we don't agree, but we will get along and respect each other's views. You know, you live next door to me, and we don't agree on anything, but I'll get your mail when you go on vacation and you loan me your lawnmower. You know, that was tolerance. They've co-opted the good meaning of tolerance, but they've forced their own artificial meaning on it. What they call tolerance in practice is the most intolerant thing you will ever see. What it boils down to in practice is you must agree with me or be silenced or re-educated or not get that degree, and it happens quickly, and it's loud, and it's vocal. You know, one of the things, if you're going to have anti-discrimination laws, it's supposed to be based on your having some kind of genuine disadvantage, financial disadvantage, historical disadvantage. The civil rights laws were, in my opinion, a great moral leap forward. I know when I hear the civil rights arguments, nobody gets angrier than my African-American pastor friends. They get infuriated. I've seen them show up to rallies and they say, don't you dare try to compare centuries of slavery, what it did to our families, what the Jim Crow laws, don't you dare try to compare your behavior to that experience that generated those laws. They are furious about it, and they are by far the most conservative demographic on these issues. And the other thing that usually you have is economic disadvantage or political powerlessness. The people pushing these don't have any of those. Now, I can't confirm this, and I want to say this as a fact, but I heard earlier from Jeff that there's been one reported incident in Montana under any of these, discrimination ordinances. Who is really powerless in society today? You know, when the former CEO of Mozilla, when it came out that he gave $1,000 to support Proposition 8 in 2008, he was hounded out of his office as CEO of Mozilla. He's not fit to serve, right? When's the last time you heard about a CEO, and plenty of them pump a lot of money into redefining marriage? When's the last story you heard in the news about somebody being hounded out because they gave money to defeat Prop 8? Anybody hear any? The Benham brothers have a big contract with HGTV. They're going to do Flip It Forward, where they help poor people get into homes, until it comes out that they believe in the traditional view of marriage. And HGTV drops them just like that, right? Duck Dynasty. Now, you'll find all kinds of shows on these cable television. You'll find now new, like, polygamy-type shows. Does anybody ever get upset and say, I'm really offended you have this show with such loose, you know, morals on it? No, it's unheard of. It's one way. You know, the mayor of Chicago says, if you're Chick-fil-A, your founder gave money, you know, to support Prop 8, you're not welcome in Chicago. Have you ever heard of a mayor say to Starbucks, well, you gave money to redefine marriage, so you're not welcome here in this city? It would be like an uproar. You'd hear it all over. Oh, look at this bigotry. But it just doesn't happen that way. You know, I've not heard of any professor being denied tenure. In fact, if anything, The professors who are endangered in public universities are the conservatives. I think Mike Adams was here not long ago, and he was a client of ours, a professor at UNC, and he was a very popular professor when he was when in his words, he was an atheist. And he had a religious conversion, became very conservative, big Second Amendment guy, and all of a sudden, all the professors in his department, we can't give him tenure. He's conservative. He's religious now. And he ended up going to a jury trial, and a jury found in his favor that they had discriminated against him on the basis of his faith. But the reality in the culture today is more that. Somebody can get up and talk about marriage equality, their term, which is a misnomer, till they're blue in the face, and everybody sits and they applaud. You know, and what irks me, too, is like there's some kind of courage to that act standing up in the culture today doing that. There's no courage needed for that. The culture fawns all over you. The courage that's needed is people in this room who are going to stand up and say, my religiously informed beliefs are such and such. I don't hate anybody. I don't use that rhetoric. But I don't want my rights compromised because that's what I believe. You're going to be far more likely to have these kinds of actions come against you. And we see them in virtually every state. We see them in employment increasingly. We even see them against religious nonprofits. Another word I just want to throw out to you because you're going to hear it come up. The word discrimination. And I've already asked at the breakfast this morning. I'll ask it again here. How many of you hear the word discrimination and you immediately have an unfavorable association that there's something wrong and evil about it? Raise your hand when you hear that. Yeah, it should be just about all of us. Discrimination is not evil. There are types of discrimination where you make assumptions that make it evil. The word discrimination just means you have criteria. In fact, once upon a time, if you said to somebody, you have discriminating tastes, that was actually a compliment. What it means is you are selective. But we are selective in every area of our life for everything. The athletic teams discriminate on the basis of athletic ability. The National Honor Society discriminates on the basis of grade. Do you have a girls' track team? You got a pretty good one. I saw somebody in the paper this morning set a new record in the 100-meter dash or something. Isn't that discriminating on the basis of sex? It is. Is it wrong? No, that's an acceptable classification that we take to distinguish girls' sports and boys' sports. There's nothing evil or improper about that. And we always have allowed these things, and we've allowed private groups to get together and say what they believe, because otherwise everything becomes nonsense. If you're going to say to an animal rights club, you have to have hunters running your club, because if not, you're discriminating against hunters. They've got to tell you what you believe. Or if you have a Save the Earth Club, and we used to get this in college cases all the time. If there was a Christian club, they were told, you have to have an atheist running your club. Do you require the Young Democrats to have a Republican? Well, no. Do you require the Save the Earth Club to have a BP executive? Well, of course not. How could we do that? Well, how can you have a Christian club? How could you compel them to have an atheist to tell them what they believe? Well, they're discriminating on the basis of religion. The Supreme Court and Congress have always said you have to discriminate on the basis of religion because otherwise everything is meaningless. Are you going to tell a Catholic school you have to hire Protestants to teach about papal infallibility? Are you going to tell a yeshiva you've got to hire Muslims to teach the Torah? Every group has to discriminate in favor of their own beliefs, including who their ministers are, how they do their sacraments, what they believe theologically, what values they draw from the Bible or the Scripture or whatever on these issues. And that's just fundamental. So because, though, that's fundamental, what happens now, though, is the word discrimination gets thrown out, and the effort is to sort of throw a hook into it and equate it to genuine, what's evil discrimination, which was racial discrimination, which is a shameful chapter of our nation's history. And the attempt to associate those together fouls people up. You hear the word discrimination. What was wrong with racial discrimination? It started with the premise that people created in the likeness and image of God were somehow inferior because of their skin color. That was the concept there. And so there are types of discrimination that are bad, you know, and I've had to go into this with judges and lawyers. If you have a chess club in a high school, are they allowed to discriminate in favor of people who play chess? Yes. Could they say, but you can't be on the chess club if you're Jewish? No. That's the evil kind of discrimination. Why? There's no connection between that and playing chess. But there is a connection between being religious and walking in the things that you believe in and living out your religious mission and beliefs. So don't let the word discrimination freeze you, like you've just had a charge thrown at you, you don't know what to do with this, because you have to look not at the word and the power of the word, you look behind it. What are we actually dealing with? What is this requiring? What is this doing here? So time to close this, but just let me say, when people stand, look, as human beings, we naturally want to get along and respect other people. We want our views to be respected. When you hear words like dignity, we're denied the dignity. Let me tell you something. We get dignity because of our religious beliefs and how they compel us to live and what we don't want to be forced to do. And this collision is absolutely inevitable. Even the ordinances that you've had so far around you were very narrow, that they only hit churches. They did not protect the photographers of the world who don't want to do the same-sex commitment ceremony. They don't protect all these other types of things. They don't even necessarily protect religious schools. And I've never seen one of, it's a one-way ratchet. I've never seen one go the other way, like, oh, gee, we didn't mean to do that to people. Let's take that back. It just continually goes toward this because the view is sort of that it's unacceptable. So with so few complaints filed, this is not something where people are politically powerless. They're not financially disadvantaged. There's no history of the discrimination. So why do we need these? Or I think these are completely unnecessary. Plus, they generally get protections just from the regular anti-discrimination laws. Why is it that this is insisted upon? Because it's making a statement. It's a way that you now have a weapon that if somebody disapproves, if you simply say, my family upbringing, my moral teaching from my church is that certain behaviors separate us from God, and this is a type of it. That becomes the wrong answer. In some states, it's become hate speech. And that's what happens with this. So let's do this. Let's take a 5-minute break.